Okay, welcome. Tonight is January 29th, 2022. This is our sixth lesson of the series of this year, and I titled it The Greatness of Poland. I know we spoke about a little bit about the Torah in Poland, but before that, I just want to just make a just have in mind we're dedicated. Tonight is the yahrzeit of Rabbi Levine, Rabbi David Levine. Mm-hmm. So David Aaron ben Yitzchak Leib, I think it is, Halevi Levine. He was a phenomenal educator in all of South Florida for many years, especially in Forest Hayim. Lived in the community, Davin here in the shul. Okay. Torah greatness of Poland. So we were talking about last few weeks. We were really talking about a lot of the greatness. We Poland really took off in the early 1500s with the coming of Rabbi Jakub Pawlik and his introducing of Pilpul, which really reinvigorated the yeshivas, and the yeshivas started taking off. Again, Pilpul did have its retractions; it had its disadvantages, and as the time went on, the antagonists became more vocal, but nevertheless, it did something, and it opened up the yeshiva world, the Poland, and the yeshivas started to become full. We spoke about his Talmud with Shalom Shachna, and his Talmud was the Ramah. We spent a night on talking about the Ramah. We also spoke a night about talking about his contemporary cousin, the Marshal. We also spoke a little bit about the Vat Arba Artzos, the organization that kept the Jews sort of in line, that kept Torah great. And tonight I wanted to just focus on a few things. First, I wanted to focus maybe a little bit about the shtetl life. What did it look like in each town? And also maybe cover a few, just more quickly, a few other great rabbanim during this period. And again, this period is beginning, let's say, 150 years or so, the beginning of the 1500s, and all the way until Tachtatak, until Chmielnitsky's uprising, which really changed everything. Change everything about Poland, and during this time, the Jews have it very well. Things are going well. Things are working economically. The Jews are doing great. They have a lot of support from the kings and the nobles. They have their retractors, from the church, and they're giving them a hard time. There's always pushback from them because religiously and competitively, also there. They always want to put the Jews back. But here, they economically, they're doing well. And often when economics are good and people don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from, support of Torah also goes up. So when a lot of this year comes from in Rabbi Irons. He's the Rosh Kollel in Detroit. And he quotes a sefer called Nasan Nata's Vivei HaMitzula. And that sefer really is a sefer that talks about Tachtatak. It talks about the massacres, the Chmielnitsky's massacres with the Jewish and what all the Jews went through. But before he does that, he paints the picture of what Poland looked like beforehand. So he wrote some. This first of all just happens to be a. Shiloh Tshuva from the Ramah. He says, "Don't think that the butchers and ritual examiners of crack are simpletons who only practice mitzvahs out of habit. This is not so. On the contrary, it is common knowledge that all the butchers and ritual examiners are rabbis and scholars. They are knowledgeable and are well trained in the give and take of Torah scholarship." And this is a response from Yosef shows Castellans, of the Ramah. Okay, so this is something that it was just common knowledge. Just you would think that wasn't this way all over. All over you'd have a you'd have the shofet, and the shofet was good at what he did. He knew all the halachas of shechita, but for him to be a tremendous talmud chacham wasn't always the norm. Okay, so this the Yavin Hamitzula, he starts like this: Paul in the pillar of Torah, there's no need to offer proofs for something that is common knowledge. There never was so much Torah throughout all of the diaspora of Israel as in the land of Poland. Every single community supported the yeshiva. And again, a lot of communities, what we would call shtetlach, a lot of little villages, they would give sufficient support to their Rosh Yeshiva so that he would be able to conduct studies without financial worry. So that the study of Torah would be his sole occupation. The Rosh Yeshiva would never leave his home throughout the year except to go to and from the Beis Medrash and to the Beis Knesset. He would sit there day and night and would only be involved in Torah study. And he goes on, every community would support Bachram, older Bachram, who would provide them with fixed weekly incomes so that they would be able to study with the Rosh Yeshiva. They would also give each Bachram at least two boys, younger students, to teach in order to articulate the Gefes. Now, Gefes is an acronym, Gimel, Pei, Sof, which is Gemara, Perish, and Tesis. Perish, I guess, is Rashi. So, then he studied in order to become accustomed in Pilpul. They would give the boys food from the charity fund or from special food collections. If the community consisted of 50 householders, Balabatim, they would support at least 30 Bachrim and boys. This is like, you know, every, like a little village of 50 people, they had, you know, again, 30, in addition, 30 Bachrim, and a Rosh Yeshiva, and maybe other Rebbeim as well. One bacher with two boys would stay at the home of a householder. At the very least, the bacher would eat on a regular basis at his table like one of his family. Even though the bacher had sufficient stipend from the community, the householder would, as a rule, not charge him for food and drink that he needed. Some of the generous householders would treat the boys like members of his family and provide all three of them with food and drink throughout the year. So they had their foods, they had their meals taken care of. They also got a little stipend if they need money, and they're able to learn with, you know, with
the parents
have to pay tuition. Huh? Right, I guess that's about tuition. But yeah, they learn without worry. They didn't have to worry about where their next meal is coming in, you know, and they would be hungry or cold, etc. There was almost no home in all of Poland where Torah was not learned. Either the householder was a scholar, or his son or son-in-law was scholars, or a bacher was a member of his household. Sometimes all of the above together existed in one house. They fulfilled all three things that Rava said in the second chapter of Shabbos. Rava said he was compassion for rabbis, will have children that will become rabbis. He honors rabbis, will have son-in-laws as rabbis. He was in awe of rabbis, will he himself become a rabbi. That is why there were so many scholars in every single community. In the community of 50 householders, there were 20 scholars who had the title Moreinu or Chaver. Rosh Yeshiva towered above that, and all the scholars were subservient to him and would go to him to study in the yeshiva. Says, these are the Rosh Yeshivas were the best of the best, the hierarchy. In every community, Rosh Yeshiva was highly honored. Whether one was rich or poor, his words were followed and no one dared to oppose him. No one lifted his hand or foot without his permission. But what he decreed became law. He had the power to inflict corporal punishment, to fine publicly shame those who violated the law, and to institute legislation in order to ensure moral integrity to the community. Despite all of this, they loved the Rosh Yeshiva. If one would have a choice piece of food, such as chicken, he would give half or all of it away to the Rosh Yeshiva. That's what it was. As they would constantly honor him with other gifts, such as money, silver, gold, especially fed cattle or fallow fish, was of superior quality. Also in the shul, most of the people purchased mitzvahs. I mean, they would buy the aliyahs. Would honor the Rosh Yeshiva with the mitzvah. Rosh Yeshiva had the chiyuv to shlishi. You know, he had the right to get shlishi on every Shabbos. And at least the first day of Yom Tov. The Rosh Yeshiva was a kohen or levi, his chiyuv was the aliyah of kohen or levi or Aharon. This was the case even though there were many kohen or levi in the shul. That's how they... No one left the shul on Shabbos or Yom Tov until the Rosh Yeshiva first departed, followed by the student body of his yeshiva. That's it. So shul, everybody stayed. After Don Olam, Rosh Yeshiva would first go out, and then the students, and only then everybody would follow. would leave and would escort him all the way to his house. On the onset of Yontif, Rabbi Yehuda would walk to his house in order to welcome the approach of the holidays. The great honor afforded the Rashi would serve him as an incentive for all of the scholars, who would constantly devote themselves to study so that they too would reach such a level to be appointed as Rosh Hashiva in some communities. As they call out, Mitrach Shalom L'Shmam Baal L'Shmam. So this is what the honor, you have the Rosh Hashiva, people say, oh my God, look what the honor is, so they would want to become a Rosh Hashiva too. If, you know, just even just for that, that's Mitrach Shalom L'Shmam, but eventually when you start learning it, it will be the L'Shma. So this is what the picture that the Rav Nassim Nata paints.
What time frame were we talking about?
The 1500s up until the right before the Khmelnytsky, until 1648.
Right before
the Khmelnytsky's uprising. Right. So this is that the story of it. That like
this was long before
Poland
was
never the same.
Long before the Holocaust.
Well, 1648, the Holocaust would be 300 years later.
1939.
So up until this is what we're talking about. And he's writing this in the 1600s. So this is the early 1600s, you know, up until 1648.
And the government wouldn't interfere, didn't have a
law.
While
this is going on, we were talking about the Arba, the Vat Arba Arches.
Okay.
So in Poland they had these fairs that took place twice a year in two major cities. One was in Lublin, I forget, the other one was Kremich, another city, I don't remember. And basically this was where merchants came, all, you know, and all the yeshivas were very well represented too. And the Vat Arba Arzos, which is the organization that was the organization that ran Poland.
Okay.
So you had Rabbanim there, they had a Bezdin, any major court cases were sent there and they would make takanos and they would be in charge of raising, collecting the taxes, and that's who the governments would deal with.
Yes.
So this is happening on a broader scale and this is what's happening in the villages. No man left in the morning to his business without hearing words of Torah delivered by a scholar, whether it's Rashi's commentary, the Torah prophets, the holy writings, or Mishnayos, or practical halacha, each one studied according to his desire of his heart. So Torah was reigning supreme. This is how it all looked. Everywhere in Poland, especially in our city of Krakow, which thank God is a major population center, there are at times 5 or 6 weddings a day, which often continue onto the night. This is the Tshuva, this is what the Ramah said. This is a little bit now how the yeshiva looked like. I don't know if it was every yeshiva, but it sounded like most of the yeshivas followed the schedule, which I'm about to say. The following was the educational system in Poland. The Zman was the time when the Bachurim and the boys were required to study with the yeshiva. In the summer, the Zman lasted from the beginning of Iyar, which is after Pesach, right? After Pesach, beginning of the year, they had 2 weeks after Pesach to get themselves together to the 15th of Av, to Tu B'Av, which is pretty much what they do now. The summer sets, this summer is minus, most of these sheaves have this month. In the winter, it lasted from the beginning of Cheshvan, which also many of these sheaves start Rosh Chodesh Cheshvan, until the 15th of Shvat. Okay, so we go straight to Pesach. Here they divide the winter's month up into two parts. After the 15th of Shvat and the 15th of Av, the Bachurim and the boys had permission to leave, if they so desired, and study in the place of their choice, from beginning of Iyar to the holiday of Shavuos. And in the winter, from the beginning of Cheshvan until Chanukah, the entire yeshiva would learn Gemara, Peirush, Rashi, and Tarsus. That was the Gethus, with great diligence. So in other words, whatever Masechta that they were learning, we also mentioned last time that the Vad would encourage. This is, you know, the printing press had just come out, and they're printing out volumes of Gemara just coming out. So the Vad, in order to help with the selling of the Gemaras that are coming out, encouraged or forced the yeshivas to learn the Masechta of the volume that just came out. Right? It's a, you know, and how they, the daf that we have today was all being formed at this time, you know, with the like four lines of Rashi on the inside and Tosfos on the outside, and infarction in the back. This is all being developed now, and one sept at a time is coming out, so they would ask all the yeshivas to learn the same mesecta. So it seems that for the first half of the Zman of the winter Zman, they would just learn Gemara, Rashi, and Tosis. See, this is the Pilpulim system. Okay, the Pilpul system, like we mentioned before, was a more learning what's not in the Gemara, what's underneath or behind the Gemara, what's not said, what the Gemara is leaving out. They had a certain system of, well, why does the Gemara say this, and why doesn't it say something else? What did we think beforehand? So some of the questions are good that we do today, but they had a different system of creating and building different Gemaras. But so far, this part which I read, all yeshivas do. This is not part of the Pilpul yet. So, from the beginning of year to the holiday Shavuos, and the winter from the beginning of Cheshvan until Chanukah, the entire yeshiva would learn, Rashi and Tosfos. Each day they would learn halacha. They define halacha by one column of Gemara, Peirush, Rashi, and Tosfos. So, I guess they would do one page. Sounds like they would do an Amud a day. Every one of the scholars and bachurim in the community, as well as anyone with connections to Torah study, would come to the yeshiva to be by the Rosh Hashiva. Only the Rosh Hashiva sat on a chair while all the scholars, as well as the rest of the yeshiva, would be standing right by him. Before the Rosh Hashiva would enter the yeshiva, they would all be actively involved in discussion, which would be pilpul. When the Rosh Hashiva would enter, each of them would ask him the questions that bothered them regarding the halacha, which sounded like Gemara, Rashi, Tosfos. He would first answer all the questions. It would be silence, and the Rosh Hashiva would tell them what new insights he had in the halacha. After he had shared his insights, the Rosh Hashiva would deliver his chiluk, his pilpulistic discourse. He would point out contradictions in the Gemara or in Rashi's commentaries or in Tosfos and answer them. Then he would point out the answers themselves that he gave contradicted each other. Then he would give a different answer to one of the questions or something similar until the entire halacha would be clear. That's how it seems that the yeshivas were working. The session would last at least up to the beginning of the afternoon in the summer, after the Shavuos and from Chanukah up until Pesach, or until Rosh Hashanah, where Shiva would not spend that much time delivering Chlubim. He would set it together with the scholars, the Arba Turim, with commentaries. Now, we're going to discuss a little bit on the commentaries of the Arba Turim. The Arba Turim is the Shulchan Aruch. This is the forerunner of the Shulchan Aruch. This is the Tor, who is the son of the Rosh. We mentioned this in a previous lecture. He divided all the halakhas of Shas into four parts. Arachayim, Ebenezer, Yerubayim, and Shemishpa. And the Beis Yosef, the Yosef Karo, was the one who originally wrote a commentary of Beis Yosef. And that became the Torah. We're going to speak about other commentaries on that. And then the Beis Yosef himself said, I want to do something on my own. I want to make something shorter. And he created the Shulchan Aruch. And we mentioned last time that the Shulchan Aruch making its way into Europe. It had different halachos. The Sfarim were not the same. And the Ramah, he wrote glosses on the Beis Yosef. And that was the beginning of what we had as a Shulchan Aruch. So it says over here, the tour, probably with the Beis Yosef and some of the other Mefarshim, this is what they were using, lahalacha. It's detailed. It's, if you're going through the tour, it's very detailed, and it goes into a lot of the, it's not just like we have a Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, all right, what's the halacha? It goes into the Gemara, and it explains the halacha from the beginning all the way through. This is the preface to the Gilui Yechzin. Who is so deaf? This has not occurred the great name of the Yechzin. Okay, so this is I wanted to paint the scene. This is what it was in Poland, and for over 100 years, this was 150 years, and even maybe before. But for 150 years, Poland was a center, the major center of Jewish learning, of higher Jewish learning. Of yeshiva learning, and this is the way it was, and this is how this is what was lost as in totality with top to top. The higher level of learning is going to remain in Poland and Lithuania all the way through World War II, through the Holocaust. It's going to still be the center of learning, but it's not going to be all over Poland the way it was after Tachvatat, after the uprising. So the Jewish community is going to be very, very, very poor. And the economics is not going to be the way it was. And they have many, many other issues and other forces that are outside that's going to affect the Jewish community. And to such a point that it's going to be a large part of the Jewish community that was just like nothing. And that's where Chassidus came in. The Baal Shem Tov came in, and he had an answer, and he had a great answer, and an answer that was very, very successful in taking Poland out from, you know, nothing, just and bringing them up into a vibrant Jewish community, Jewish life again. But that's like the story is way ahead. Now, I wanted to just focus just on a number of very different personalities, different Rabban that we all are familiar with. And the first one, and these were all Rabban and people that lived in Poland at the time. And there were two tracks that were really happening now, from the Gemara and from the Halacha. Like I said before, there was you had the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch. And in those two, what was happening is, as other Rabbanim were coming in, they were all adding and arguing on the halachas that were going on. And we're going to go through some of those Rabbanim now. So if you look open to any page of the Torah, you'll notice a number of commentaries. They were all in Poland at this time. At the same time, the Gemara, Rashi, and Tosis, there were also Mefarshim that were coming out at this time, really all explaining the Gemara, Rashi, and Tosis. Mainly like the Marshal we spoke about already, the Marshal, the Maran, and others were explaining, doing the same thing with Gemara, Rashi, and Tosis. So I'd like to just maybe focus in on a number of these individuals. And the first one is the Maral. Maral really was all in a class by himself. He was just an unbelievable thinker. He was an unbelievable philosopher, if you will. And we know of the Maral from, mainly he was in Prague, but he did spend 10 years at one time, 4 years at another time, in Poland. And he did have a tremendous influence in Poland at the time. So, Megillas Yochsen, he writes, who is so deaf as not to have heard of the great name of the extraordinary Gaon, the Maral? It is beyond human ken to fully express the entirety of his greatness, the myriads of wonders and thousands of deliverances from our enemies which he brought in his generation. And so what are some then? He says, since Poland was the land of my birth, this is the tale of the brother of the Maral of Prague. So he writes, since Poland was the land of my birth and I was raised there between the knees of the most prestigious of the Rosh Yeshivas, especially in the Yeshiva of the amazing Rav Shachna. Again, Rav Shachna was the Talmud of Rav Yaakov Pollack, the Rebbe also of the Ramah, he's going to mention. I studied at the same time with the author of the Ramah. There have been 26 years since I'm standing in this community. So you get an idea of the Tzal, the brother of Maral. Maral was also about this time. He probably also with his brother who grew up in Poland at the time. He probably also was in Rav Shachna's yeshiva. Afterwards in the year 1573, this is the sefer of the Tzemach David. The Tzemach David is Rav David Gantz. And he was a Talmud of the Ramah, also a great Talmudist in his own right, and a philosopher. I think he was an astrologer. Afterwards, in the year 1573, he's talking about the morale. He came to Prague, established many disciples, founded a small group called the Claws, the Clouds. How do you say it? Clouds? He spread Torah there for a period of 11 years, and afterwards for 4 years. On Thursday, the 4th of Iyar in 1592, he left Prague once again to go to Poznan, which is in Poland, become the Rosh Yeshiva and head of the rabbinical court of all over Poland. So in 1592, he was the Rav of Poland. Prague, this would be over here, and Poland is in the map. Poznan is, this is where Poznan is, and this is about what Poland looked like. At the time, Poland was a great country. It was a strong country, and it, prosperous country. After the 1650s, they slowly but surely it was just down, pretty much downhill from there. But at the time, it was a major country and it was very, very popular. We just had these pictures. Now, of course, we know the morale. What's the first thing you ever think of?
The
golem. So this happens to be his shoe in Prague. Right? If you look closer, I remember some of you remember these pictures. On his shoe, you see these rungs in the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So you have to get yourself a ladder and you have to go up the rungs of the run. You see over here there's a door. Right?
Yeah.
So that's where they would say that's where the golem is.
That's where the what?
Okay? The golem. That's where if there is a golem, that's where it is. This is a picture of, they have a statue of the golem. It's not about the morale, so I don't want to focus in on this, but most likely the morale's golem didn't exist. It probably most likely, with David Gans, who wrote about the morale, who knew him, didn't make any mention of his.
There's so many stories about him.
Right. So they talk about his deliverances and things, and he was very instrumental in saving the Jewish community in many ways. If there's a leftover of the golems up there. If you wanted to check out, the stories that the Nazis were going up there and they were slumping them out dead. That's where they would have slept them out. I just wanted to.
Well, there wouldn't be anything left because they said that the end,
they're
all destroyed and the morale.
Right, whatever, it would be fighting dirt or whatever. So if you go up and put dirt around and put like that. And again, the legend is that he made a golem. To such a point is that in the city of Prague, they have a picture of a golem.
Are you not allowed to go up there?
I don't know.
No, you're not.
Huh?
You're not allowed to go there.
They probably won't let you. I don't know what's up there. So yeah.
Is that a statue based on
the golem.
Certain individual's conceptions of it?
Yeah, probably. Mm-hmm. Probably. I can't imagine it was really like the Jewish community put up statues. We don't put statues up too much. I should think to put up statues.
It's a nice idea to fire up people to
make. Right. Okay, I just wanted to mention the golem because, when you talk about the morale, you talk about the golem, they're great stories. I have in my library, I have that comic book, that's the picture of the books with the golem. It's just, they're great, great, great stories. So
somebody
wrote Winkler.
Somebody
wrote Winkler put out the whole stories of golem.
Somebody wrote a book, which I don't see published anymore. Maybe several books on the golem, and it was written like it was dust or.
Yeah, okay. Well, I know Rabbi Winkler.
Winkler.
Gershon Winkler.
That's the golem
name also said that.
That's the
golem name. Okay, fair. Oh, the back pages. You had them as well. All right. So now, one of the things, this is a preface to the Tosfos Yontif. Tosfos Yontif. He himself was a later leader of the Polish community, and he was a Talmud of the Maral, and he wrote a Perush on the Mishnah. And like in the Yachton Bolas Mishnayos, in the main Mishnayos, I don't think I had a picture here of it, but in the Mishnayos, it looks like the Gemara that's in the middle, and on the inside is the Rav, Rav Avadja Mibatanura, and on the outside is the Tosas Yantav. And his name is, I may discuss him a little later, two Tosas Yantav Heller, a little bit in Heller, which I may get to him. I do have him up here. We'll see if we get to him. But he was a student of the Maral, and this is what he says about the Maral. In the same vein as Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Now, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was the one that made the Mishnayos. Before Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, this is in the year like 200 of the Common Era. We're in the year 2022, so about 1,800 years ago, 1,800 years ago, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was the leader of the generation. He was like the end of the Tanayim, after Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was the Amorayim. And he went at it, he was rich. He was like a throwback in terms of his Chachma for a few, for generations before. He had clout. He had a very good relationship with the Roman Caesar at the time, who happened to have been Marcus Aurelius, and he had money, he was rich, and he was the Nasi. Putting all this together, at that time, things were not going well with the Romans, they were being very hard-handed. This we're coming after the Bar Kokhba rebellions, which in 70 years earlier was the destruction of the Mikdash, and they had a window of an opportunity, and they felt that the Nasi and the Chachamim at the time felt that they had to start writing things down. So until Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, everything was balkan. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi came and he said, okay, we're going to start making it. He decided every time he got everybody together and somebody would say something, he'd say, that's Iker, that's primary, and we're going to put that in, that's a Mishnah. That secondary, that's going to be called a Braisa on the outside. So he organized all of the Mishnayos, he organized it into six sections, Zrayim Moed Nashim, Zikin, Kachin Taris, and it was, I believe, 4,200 Mishnayos about, and that was the basis for the next 300 years. The Amorayim would discuss the Mishnayos, and eventually that was the Gemara. So in the year 500 under Ravina and Ravashi, that was the Gemara. So what Tosfos Yantav says in the same vein, the Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, our great teacher, Rabbi Yaakov Yehuda Levo Bezalel of blessed memory, who was involved in the yeshiva, spread the teachings of Torah to the multitudes in the form of great measure, referring to the study of Talmud, well known, he stressed the study of Mishnah. So the Maral said, I guess it wasn't common before, to take just and study Mishnayos. Learn Mishnayos as a subject in of itself. I heard from somebody, I don't remember where I heard it, that Mishnayos, just Mishnayos, if you take out all the Gemara, is about 40% of Shas. All the great concepts, important concepts, and major machlokas are all out in the Mishnayos. So the Maral, he would have people study Mishnayos, and that would became just, let's go through the Mishnayos, as opposed to just going through all of the Gemara. So that was something that the Maral pushed for, and Tosfos Yantav, he actually wrote a parish based on that, and his parish was based on the Rav of the Bartanura, and the Tosfos Yantav would, comment, like almost like Tosfos and Rashi. The Rav, Rav Avadya the Bartanura, who had moved to Yerushalayim, was the Rav of the Yerushalayim in the late 1400s, he became, that was like the Rashi, and Tosfos Yantav, it was really called, I think, Tosefus, but it became like Tosfos in Tosfos. So. It had such an effect that groups upon groups of true royalty, rabbinic scholars, were involved in the study on a daily basis, one chapter at a time until they finished, and again continued to repeat the cycle. Through Hashem's help, this gained permanence not only in Prague, where it was originated by the Gaon Maral, but also in other holy communities, both far and near, where they seriously in the sense of the study. By the way, just throwing out a plug here, there's just like there is Daf Yomi, which was started by Mayor Shapiro of Lublin. And there's also the Agudah started as a Seder also called Mishnayis Yomis. And you do two Mishnayis a year. And
a day.
Two Mishnayis a day. And you finish in about 6 years. So it takes you about 6 years to do all of Mishnayis. So Mishnayis Yomis just finished about a month ago. About a month ago. And now they're starting again. So if anybody's interested in picking it up, we're in Peya, I believe we're in the second or third parak of Peya. In Brachos and in Peya, so.
Chapter 3.
The third parak, okay. That was one of the things. Greater was the impact of the statements of our great Rabbi Marwal than the statements of Rabbeinu HaKodesh. The form of study Mishnayis that was established at the behest of the Gaon was not merely the road study and annotation of the text alone, but rather study with commentary. This is what I meant by referring to the greater influence that our master had over Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. This is because he instituted the Mishnah to be studied in a way that is akin to studying Mishnah together with Gemara. And this is all written by the Tosfos Yontif, Rabbi Tosfos Lipman Hillel, who eventually became the Rabbi in Krakow. I'm just going to just touch on this quickly because it's not really part of Polish history, but the Maral, he was a big philosopher, and one of his things is this is how his books went. His Sifri Maral went, it says, according to both the interpretations of the Bryce and of Shiloh, that the Exodus is rightly called Gvuras Hashem. So he has a sefer called Gvuras Hashem. This work, which deals with the system of reality, is divided into six books. The first book, I don't know if he finished all of these six books, or but this was his plan in terms of all his. The first book deals with history and philosophy. The second book deals with the Pesach Seder. Third is the giving of the Torah called Sefer Tiferes Yisrael. Fourth is devoted to Tisha B'Av. Fifth is Sukkos, and it's called Sefer Ahod. And the sixth section deals with Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, and it's called Sefer Shemayim Ve'aretz. I don't know if he finished all of these books, but that was his goal and how he wanted to do it. That was his philosophy on establishing from the Yom Tovim, and also the Sfiros. If you notice, this is like Hod and Tiferes, and he also connected one with the other. There was a very big controversy or something that happened. I believe that the Maral was imposing when this happened. It was called a Nadler controversy. What happened is just the story was that there was a family that had to separate, and it seems that much later, this boy was read as a shidduch to a girl, and it turns out that they were brothers and sisters. They were a brother and a sister. So the family claimed, and most likely it was true, but it was checked in by many rabbanim, and mainly Maral and others, that that they realized this right away. That one of them had that the brother had some sort of a mole, and they realized that they were brothers and sisters, and that's it. They just separated, each went their own way, and each had children. They both got married separately and they had children. However, people were claiming that they actually married each other, and they had kids, and these kids, and if that did happen, these kids would be monogamous. And the Rabbanim checked into this, and they realized that this didn't happen, but there were people from this family, the Nadler family, they were just kept being bored up and up again. So this is what the Maral writes about this. The whole of this family is well entrenched and is exceedingly multiplied. There are many great legal authorities in Israel who are without equal in wisdom and Torah, who have already joined that family on a daily basis. They are even now intermarrying with them. Therefore, if anyone calls anyone of that family by the nickname Mo, expressing Colin a miser, it is equivalent that it is its equivalent, and the person is subject to flogging and must appease the other party as is detailed above. This is in the in this situation, which based solely upon women of stored doubt, it is obvious that they are of kosher status and they are not invalid. This is the actual Somo in Baba Kama. This actually is a marshal that we spoke about. He wrote this in the Yamshel Somo. This was by the Maral himself. This is a Shabashuva drasha in Prague. It is therefore mentioned that the ban of the excommunication that was imposed by the previous generation, not the libel of dead, especially not the libel of a Jew, with the
Nagler.
This was done here in the Holy Community of Prague on Shabbos Shuva 5344, 1584, wherein we issued a terrible and awesome ban with 10 secret terrors for the scholars of the Holy City of Prague, each one of them holding a sacred term in his hand, not to libel the dead and not to mention the taint of Nagler in association with any Jew. It is befitting to observe the ban issued by the previous generations, in addition to this ban that was issued in public. So he redid the ban in Prague in 1584. I guess it was such a serious issue, it was like one of these things that wouldn't go away. Okay, next thing is the morale and educational system. One of the things that the morale and his educational system felt very important is that before you learn Gemara, you should know Tanakh. I know it's very, some of these issues just, you know, they're just still here with us. And but that's the way he felt very strongly. He says, how could you know you're going to go, you know, Gemara, we're going to quote a chumash, quote a pasuk, and you don't even know what the pasuk is talking about. So he felt very strongly in morale that that's what should be done.
Yeah.
I consider myself worthy of God's grace because ever since the time I reached maturity, I have devoted my energies to understanding the wisdom and foolishness of the generation in regards to the study of Torah. In my opinion, the system is incorrect and is a departure from the path of our forefathers and holy predecessors. It is impossible to make any valid comparison between the level of our generation and theirs. It is not a matter of degree, but of kind. That is why some years ago, with the vigor of a lion, I began to correct the educational system in accordance with my views. I was not successful, however, for the generation said that we ought to follow the opinion of the majority. Some time ago, I roused myself and wrote letters to the communities in Poland and Russia to institute needed changes in order to correct certain abuses. I was also not successful in my efforts. I have still all of my former strength, and perhaps my words will have an effect upon those that Hashem is inspiring and will accept my advice and rebuke them in order to better themselves in this world and the next. When the students begin to study Talmud, he is just as bare of knowledge of Sukkim as when he first began to study the Sukkim. He doesn't have adequate knowledge of even one single section of the Torah. It is rare to find someone who is acquainted with the Sukkim. If someone makes an attempt to guide them on the true and proper path, they tell them that he is in the minority. One should follow the majority. Don't ask, what are you doing that for? Everybody does it our way. For this does myself lament. To relate in detail all the ills would be too burdensome and would depress the listeners. For all of the above do I lift up my voice and rage like a lion, and cry bitterly, and my eyes shed profuse tears. They mentioned that what would happen is they every week they do the weekly parsha, and they do a little section of it, and then the next week they do the next parsha, and they do a little bit of it, and they never would study any one parsha. The way we do it in yeshiva is, you know, in starting the first grade, you start with Lech Lecha, Vayikra, wherever you start, but, you know, the parsha is a separate thing. But you learn Chumash, and, you know, you pretty much try to get through most of, depends on the yeshiva, you get through Shemos, you get into Mishpatim, maybe. The girls, they do a lot more, they spend more time in, so I think that's what is more in line with what the morale was concerned about. So at least we do that as young kids. Instead of before you learn Mishnah, you sit, you learn Chumash and Rashi, and you understand what the parashas are about. But if you're gonna, you go to Lech Lecha, you go to Vayera, and you don't learn about the wars between the four, you know, the four kings and the five kings, and then you go to Hadi Sarah, and the next thing is Sarah's dead, and you know, you don't even know the story with Eliezer and Rivka because you didn't get that far, and then the next thing is Toldos, and you have Yaakov and Esau, and you're just missing major parts of the Chumash, and I think that was one of the issues that the Maral had. In the year 1598, Maral turned to first Krakow, went to Prague. He served as chief rabbi for more than 10 years until his death in Prague in the month of Elul. So he was 10 years in the end of his life in Prague. That's how we know him from the Maral in Prague. Okay, I wanted to show you, this is an example of the tour. Okay, so this would be the tour, okay? And again, this was all structured by the original printers. You know, I guess you could have printed it all in columns. But they, when they put them all together in the 1500s, and they were putting it all together, so they made, this is how they did the Gemara, they put the Gemara in the middle with Rashi and Tosfos on the side. And they did the Torah, they reprinted the Torah that way too. So this is the Torah in the middle,
mm-hmm.
and on one side, in Arachayim, you have the Bach on one side, and the Beis Yosef, and both of these are in Poland during our time. You also have the Darki Moshe, and I mentioned Beis Yosef, he wasn't in Poland, he was a Sephardic Rav, and he's going to write the Shulchan Aruch himself. And Darki Moshe is the Ramah. So he was the Darki Moshe was really going to do what Beis Yosef was going to do, but Beis Yosef beat him to it. So Darki Moshe says in his introduction, instead of doing the same thing as the Beis Yosef, what he ended up doing is he wrote shorter comments on the Beis Yosef. So where the Beis Yosef he felt was either wrong or mistaken, or they associated left things out, that's where the Darki Moshe came in. So this is the Ramah, and the Prisha Drisha is the also in the Shulchan Aruch, is the same author as the Sma, the Sefer Meiris and Nayim, and that's where Yeshua Falk, if I'm saying his name right, Falk. So the Beis Chagash is Rav Yoel Sirkis, 1561-1640, Darki Moshe 1530-1572, and the Sma and the Drisha was from about 1550-1614. All of them around the same time. In the Choshen Mishpat. Now this is the Shulchan Aruch himself. This is the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef, instead he wanted it to be more concise. I mean, we can laugh. He wanted to be more concise. You can see how much it is. But his idea was is to be able to finish all halachas in 30 days. And that's it, 30 days you'll be able to finish everything. But that, and then came along the Ramah, and the Shach, and the Sma, and the Taz, and the Garagola. So these are just some of these. This is again, this is in Choshen Mishpat. So in Choshen Mishpat, this would be the Machaber, and in between here, you would have the Ramah. Here, this isn't a good page because it doesn't have the Ramah in between. But you have the Sma on the outside, the Shach on the inside. Sma again is 1550-1640, the Shach is 1622-1662, used by the later of them. The Taz, 1586-1667. The Taz is the son-in-law of the Bach. Okay? And the Bir Agola is Moshe Rifkis also, you don't know exactly when he was born, but he passed away in 1655. I'm just going to point out over here, this is the Bir Agora. Agora 1720 to 1797, but he made it to the page. And he's a little later, and he's also later Pshatim, more, okay. Other Pshatim, the Sefer Teshuva, the Be'er Hetek. These two, when the Chavetz Chaim wrote his Mishnah Brura, so he said that, so he made his Mishnah Brura with the Machaber, with the Machaber, the Beis Yosef, he said to keep these two in, because he got a lot of his halachas from the Be'er Heter and the Pesachim Tshuva. So he said, if you're doing the Mishnah Berurah, he didn't keep that for his family. He said, anybody can take the Mishnah Berurah, there's no copyrights on that. And he said, but when you do the Mishnah Berurah, recopy it, keep the Pesachim Tshuva and the Be'er Heter in. Anyway, okay, this is the Eben Ezer. This is the Shulchan Aruch, and this is the Eben Ezer. So here you would have the Chalkas Machokeif, Rav Moshe Lima. You have the Beis Shmuel, again 1600 to 1700. Again, Be'er Bagola, Be'er Gola. Should be Be'er HaGolah, I would say. We saw this in the other Torah Taz, we also saw before, and the Chacham Shlomo, the Chacham Shlomo. So this is, again, during this time, halach is being developed, and halach is being written, and refined, developed, argued. This is, again, the Arachayim, but this is in Arachayim in Arachayim Shulchan Aruch, and had the Magen Avraham, and the Magen Taz, the Magen Avraham, here I go. Okay, lots of these are also later people that came. okay, what do I have here? Maybe I've got time just to go through a little bit. Sma was a student of the Ramah and of the Marshal. He also had many of the Sma, had many of the next generation leaders, Mekimei Shlomo, and he was also instrumental in the Council of the Four Lands. So that's in 1580 is when the Council of the Four Lands took place. Before then, it was less official. It was called the Council of the Three Lands, but it didn't have as official strength as it did, in 1580. He was Rashid and Lemberg, and I mentioned most of these, and died in the same year as the commentary. That was the Grisha and Drisha, the commentary on Choshen Mishpah and Shulchan Aruch, and the Drisha is on the Abitur. He also wrote the other novelae as well. And okay, Rav Mordechai Yaffe is, what was he? He's known as a Lavush. He didn't make it onto the page. It's a Lavush, but what he had in mind is he saw the Torah. And he said, the Torah is too lengthy. I want to make something less. And then, I guess before, while he was working it out, also, it sounds just like the Ramah, then came out the Beis Yosef, came up with the Shulchan Aruch. Mm-hmm. And he took a look at the Shulchan Aruch and he said, it's too little. Goldilocks, this is too much, and this is too little. And therefore, he redid it on his own, and he did it, and he called it the Lavush Mordechai. And that's how and that's it. This is what we have, the Lavush today. Also, in that time, student of the Ramah, and that was also that time as well. Who do I have here? I have the Bach, the old circus. Now, the Bach was a posek, and he was also the father-in-law of the Taz. So there's just I don't know why this one story comes to mind. What was it? At age 14, he was, I guess, a child prodigy. He went to learn under the Beis Shmuel, who we mentioned before. He was invited he was a rabbi in all these different places: Lakhov, Lublin, Medjevaz, Belz. I can't say that name. Sizdalovka, Breslovac, which is Brisk, and he settled in Krakow. And many of his students became named rabbis, and David Ben Shmuel, a lady, the Taz, was his son-in-law. I just tell you a quick story about the Taz And the back, just to show you where they were, because I know why this story comes up as opposed to anything else, we'll probably end with this, is that the Taz, you know, the Baas, the way it was is, you know, you put your son-in-law in and you supported the son-in-law in the house. So the Taz took the Baas to a Bezdin. And he said, you know, the Baas promised me meat. And what he's doing is he's giving me chicken. Or he's giving me some, you know, lesser chicken. So he took him to court. And the Baas said, well, you know, chicken is still considered meat. So he had the court case. And, you know, the Taz wanted meat. And the Baas says chicken is meat. And he went to court. He went to Bezdin. And the Baas won. The Bezdin said, okay, the Baas is correct. So afterwards, they asked the Taz, like, what's going on here? You had to take your father and go to court. He says, I'll tell you why I did. He says, you know, I guess the Baas was having a hard time, so originally he was giving me meat. And then as things went going on, this is, so he couldn't afford meat, he was giving him chicken. Or a lower form of meat, not the, and the Taz says, when I was getting the chicken, I wasn't able to concentrate as much. So he was afraid, the Taz was afraid that in Shemayim, they would have tigers on the Baas. You promised me meat, and you only gave me chicken, and the Taz wasn't concentrating as much as he was able to when he had the meat. So the Taz says, I took my father-in-law to court, so Bezdin down here paskin that chicken is the same as meat, so up in Shemayim they won't have tigers on the Baas.
Wow.
That's how that story went, okay? The Taz and the Baas. All right, I guess we're going to, I guess we'll end here. I do have a few other gedolim, we'll just touch on them, and I guess if we most likely will start with Yehud Tach the Tach next week, and if not, just a few other things before we get to it. Yeah, any questions? Or? Okay, wonderful, thank you all for coming. Okay, you want to know the title? Let me just...